Thank you for listening to this sermon from Seven Springs Presbyterian Church. If you want to learn more about us, please find us on Facebook or visit us at sevenspringspresbyterian.com.
Like I said, we'll be in 1 Kings chapter 3, and we find ourselves, Solomon now sits on David's throne. It is firmly established, as we found out in chapter 2. Solomon has really taken care of any of those potential threats that might have arisen. Now he sits on the throne. He's secured his place as king, following in his father David. But we need to be reminded as that big mountain of one of those biblical verses that should always be in the back of our minds as we read through the whole Bible. That's in 2 Samuel chapter 7, particularly towards the end of the promise which God gave to David, as David asked, "I want to build you a house." And God said, "No, I'm going to build you a house that will last forever." And he speaks of this son that is going to come. And this is what God says to David: "When he commits iniquity, I will discipline him with the rod of men, with the stripes of the sons of men. But my steadfast love will not depart from him, as I took it from Saul, whom I put away from before you. And your house and your kingdom shall be made sure forever before me. Your throne shall be established forever." So now Solomon sits on David's throne, have the promise that his David's son, one of David's sons, will sit on this throne forever. And we know the promise. We know that very well. We've seen the promise. We've looked at the promise in depth. We've pointed back to the promise. But now I think the realities start to step in. David is now no longer there, and the promise starts to see how is this promise going to be carried out? It was made to David about David's son. And now one of David's sons sits on David's throne after David has gone to lie down with his fathers. So what type of king will Solomon be? 2 Samuel specifically mentioned that when he commits iniquity. It's not if he commits iniquity, but when he commits iniquity. What does that look like? What then happens to God's promises? Now as we turn to the beginning of this chapter, in chapter 3, we see the reign of King Solomon, really from, you might say, the opening stages of chapter 2 of Solomon's first steps as king. A period of maybe 2 years has gone by in that period where we looked at with Shimei being there in the house for about 2 years and then him dying. But we, in this period of time, from chapter 3 to chapter 11, we see this section of Solomon's reign, you might say. We see God's faithfulness to his covenant with David, that covenant that he made with David in 2 Samuel chapter 7, where he said constantly, many times, "I will, I will, I will." But we also, in this period of time, see a decline in Solomon. We see that decline in where the kingdom that Solomon begins with at the height, as it rises through King Solomon, he doesn't leave it in the same estate that he finds it in. There's a decline that happens in the nation of Israel as well. In tonight's passage, we see this somewhat in miniature. We see the beginning of what this kingdom is going to be like. We see warning signs. We see cracks in Solomon's crown. But we also see that thread which flows throughout all this, as it does throughout all of Scripture, of God's steadfast love and his loyalty to the promises he makes to his people. So we'll begin in verse 1 with Solomon's marriage. Verse 1 says, "Solomon made a marriage alliance with Pharaoh, king of Egypt. He took Pharaoh's daughter and brought her into the city of David until he had finished building his own house and the house of the Lord, and the wall around Jerusalem." Now we read this and, you know, we just maybe glance over this, but here is quite a verse that would be quite shocking to the people who had read this, were reading this for the first time. Quite a shock because to those who would have heard it. Here Solomon makes a marriage alliance with the king of Pharaoh. Why is this a shock? Well, we need to mention that Pharaoh really had not been mentioned ever since Exodus. Really, the books of Joshua, Judges, 1 and 2 Samuel, he's hardly ever mentioned at all. He's not a powerhouse. He's not a strong nation. He comes up two times in 1 Samuel, 1 Samuel chapter 2. There came a man of God to Eli and said, "Thus says the Lord, I did indeed reveal myself to the house of your father when they were in Egypt, subject to the house of Pharaoh." So what this connotation here in 1 Samuel is that, remember when you were underneath the bondage of Pharaoh, Pharaoh was your master and you were his slaves. So it's not a positive context which is used here. And then you fast forward to chapter 6 where he's mentioned again. "Why should you harden your hearts as the Egyptians and Pharaoh hardened their hearts after he had dealt severely with them? Did they not send the people away and they departed?" So here again, Pharaoh's mentioned. Pharaoh's mentioned that he was the one who dealt severely with them. But what is remembered, and this is what is said by the Philistines, remembering what happened to the nation of Israel, was Pharaoh sent them away. They were no longer underneath his severe hand. So both of these cases, it's used in a negative context. In 2 Samuel chapter 6, is speaking of the priests of the Philistines, who explained that they should not be like Pharaoh. And here, now Solomon, one of his first acts that's recorded is that he makes a marriage alliance with Egypt. Now, why is this negative, you might say? As I said, this is somewhat about warning signs. As we continue through the book of 1 Kings, we'll see why this is a negative. This marriage is not helpful for Solomon's reign. And here we're seeing one of the first things that is mentioned is this warning. Now, I believe this is a warning. It's a warning that is being given in Deuteronomy chapter 7. "When the Lord your God brings you into the land that you are entering to take possession of it, and clears away many nations before you, the Hittites, the Girgashites, the Amorites, the Canaanites, the Perizzites, the Hivites, the Jebusites, seven nations more numerous and mightier than you. And when the Lord your God gives them over to you and you defeat them, then you must devote them to complete destruction. You shall make no covenant with them and show no mercy to them. You shall not intermarry with them, giving your daughters to their sons and taking their daughters for your sons. For they would turn away your sons from following me to serve other gods. Then the anger of the Lord would be kindled against you and he would destroy you quickly. But thus shall you deal with them. You shall break down their altars and dash their pieces into their pillars and chop down their asherim and burn their carved images with fire." And the reason this warning exists is not because of ethnic divides. The reason this, look at what happens. The warning is that when you intermarry, particularly your sons take your daughters take sons, but more specifically, I think general, the warning is for both, is they, in verse 4, they would turn away your sons from following me to serve other gods. The reason is worship. What's the number one commandment? Remember, I'm the Lord your God who brought you out of land of where? Egypt. Why did I bring you out of land of Egypt? Out of the house of Pharaoh? So that you might be able to serve me, that I would be your God and you would be my people. You shall have no other gods before me. And yet here, the warning is that when you go and marry into these other religions, your households are not going to worship me. Now, what generally happens is not that they say God does not exist. What generally happens, they go from monotheistic, believing in one God and serving one God, to serving many gods. This is the warning. God brings them out of slavery to be a holy people, set apart to be able to worship him. And this is how this chapter starts. Solomon goes in and makes a marriage alliance, a covenant with Egypt. But we also get a hint of something that's missing that also helps us understand these coming chapters. And that is that there's something missing in this verse. He said, in verse 1, he brings Pharaoh's daughter and brings her into the city of David until he had finished building his own house, the house of the Lord, and the wall around Jerusalem. There's three things in this passage that are missing that help us understand what is going to be accomplished under Solomon's reign. Solomon's going to build a house for himself, a house for the Lord, and a wall around Jerusalem. But we also see another thing that the warning signs shows of what's happening, not just in Solomon, but also in the kingdom. These interesting points in verse 2 and 3. And the people were sacrificing in high places, however, because no house had yet been built for the name of the Lord, Solomon loved the Lord, walking in his statutes of the Father. Only he sacrificed and made offerings at the high places. So you see, this marriage alliance is already having an effect on the people of Israel. The people of Israel, like Deuteronomy 7 warned, is they're going to go in and start worshiping their gods like the nations. They're going to be drawn away. And this is what the people are doing. They're going to all these high places. They did have the tent of meeting. But here they are, worshiping in all these high places. And so, too, we see this with Solomon. Solomon is doing the exact same thing at the end of verse 3. He sacrificed and made offerings at the high places. Now, again, we have another warning in Deuteronomy chapter 12. You shall surely destroy all the places where the nations whom you shall dispose serve their gods, on the high mountains, on the hills, under every green tree. You shall tear their altars and dash into pieces their pillars and burn their ashram with fire. You shall chop down the carved images of their gods and destroy the name out of that place. You shall not worship the Lord your God in that way. But you shall seek the place that the Lord your God will choose out of all your tribes to put his name and to make his habitation there. There you shall go. And there you shall bring your burnt offerings and your sacrifices, your tithes and your contributions that you present, your vow offerings, your free will offerings, and the firstborn of your herd, of your flock, and all that you eat before your Lord, the Lord your God, and you shall rejoice, you and your household, in all that you undertake, in which the Lord your God has blessed you. So here the warning is, just as they're going to be drawn away by marrying other people who worship other gods, so too, if you keep these high places, you are going to worship other gods. But there's also another warning in there as well. Notice in verse 4, you shall not worship the Lord your God in that way. So here it's not even that you're going to these high places to worship other gods. You might be going to these high places to worship God. The golden calf is not that they make another god. The golden calf is they make a representation of the God who brought them out of Egypt, a breaking of the second commandment. They call the golden calf Yahweh. They say, this is the God that brought us out of the land of Egypt. And so, too, we see this warning here that there's something missing, something lacking. Now, there's no house of the Lord, as we see in verse 5, the place the Lord will choose to build his house. But here, they're going to all these high places. There's something that's lacking in this time. Not just only a temple, but also the heart within the people to be able to worship God. And this is exactly what they did in Judges chapter 2. And they abandoned the Lord, the God of their fathers, who had brought them out of the land of Egypt. And they went after other gods and among the gods of the peoples who were around them. They bowed down to them, and they provoked the Lord's anger. Now, this becomes a real spiritual marker throughout the book of Kings that we need to understand. How a king relates and connects to the high places is often whether a king is a good king or a bad king. Not always, but generally specific. This is one of the markers, barometers, of the spiritual health of the people, and particularly the spiritual health of the king. But again, there's something that we see in this sign, not just that there's sin within Solomon and the people of God, but also we see there's something lacking, that there's no house of the Lord. The author points that out. They're going to these high places because no house of the Lord had been built for the name of the Lord. We see this anticipation, even in these opening verses, of something that is going to happen. Something is lacking. We see this tension within the nation of Israel. We see a lot of tension actually in verse 3, where it doesn't specifically speak just to the people, but of Solomon. Solomon loved the Lord, walking in the statutes of David his father, only he sacrificed and made offerings at the high places. That here you have Solomon loved the Lord. What's the greatest commandment? Love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your might. Takes you back to that instruction that David gave to Solomon on his deathbed. Be strong and show yourself a man and keep charge of the Lord your God, walking in his ways and keeping his statutes, his commandments, his rules and his testimonies, as it is written in the law of Moses. This is also what we see. He loves the Lord, and he's also walking in the statutes of his father David. Again, this becomes another barometer that we look at in the book of 1 Kings. Is what's the relationship to this person? How is this person like or not like David? But we see one other thing there. That he sacrificed and made offerings at the high places. Now again, this is a warning sign, a crack that we see. It will be a demise, a downfall of Solomon. It's like having someone say, oh, it's a great house, but the foundation is terrible. Oh, it's a great car. The brakes just don't work. That he loved God, that is clear, we're told it. But we do see this crack in how he worships in the high places. Now if we go back to 2 Samuel chapter 6, when the ark of the Lord was brought into Jerusalem by King David, and we saw Uzzah touching the ark and dying, I think we need to see that situation like this. That we will see the demise and fall of Solomon, but that's not what we're seeing exactly right here. That here you have David who loved the Lord, but he did not worship God in the prescribed way that God had given to him. That we understand that a believer can love God, but not necessarily walk perfectly and worship God correctly. So even at this point, in these first three verses, we get a sense that Solomon's reign is going to be interesting. We get a sense that there's something that is lacking that Solomon will try and accomplish. There's something that should not be there, that's not there, the house of the Lord. We also see the king going somewhere where he should not be, going to the high places. That the king has married a person who does not worship the God of the Bible. What is going to happen with Solomon with all these things? And then we get told of this situation, beginning in verse 4, that the king went to Gibeon to sacrifice there, for that was the great high place. Solomon used to offer a thousand burnt offerings on that altar. Now Solomon goes to Gibeon. Now, interestingly, that the author does not give us a lot of information about this place. He calls it the great high place. Now this has led and caused a lot of speculation between the relationship between 1 Kings, 2 Kings, and 1 Chronicles and 2 Chronicles. That 1 Chronicles... 2 Chronicles seem to be very pro David and Solomon. That they seem to paint them in a good light. We don't get the 2 Samuel chapter 11 like we do. There's mention about that incident, what happened to David and Uriah and his wife. And so to here, the author of 1 Kings merely just says that he goes to Gibeon. Now, the author of Chronicles actually fills in a lot of blanks that we do not have. Now, I want to say that this is all merely just speculation. That here you have two different authors focusing on the same chronological events, and they're focusing on different aspects. But also, if you believe that the author of 1 Chronicles and 2 Chronicles knew that there was the book of 1 and 2 Kings, why would you just merely just write the same account word for word? You're writing to a different audience, an audience that doesn't have the house of the Lord, compared to the people who lived before Solomon had built it. But what does the author of 2 Chronicles tell us about this event? Solomon, the son of David, had established himself in his kingdom, and the Lord, his God, was with him and made him exceedingly great. Solomon spoke to all of Israel, to the commanders of the thousands and to the hundreds, to the judges and to all the leaders in all Israel, to the heads of the fathers' houses. And Solomon, the assembly with him, went to the high place that was in Gibeon for the tent of the meeting of God, which Moses, the servant of the Lord, had made in the wilderness, was there. But David had brought up the ark of God from Kiriath-Jearim to a place that David had prepared for it, for he had pitched a tent for it in Jerusalem. So we find out that here Solomon is going not just to merely any high place and not just a great high place that everyone likes. It's great because that's where the tent of meeting is. He worships at these high places, but here he goes to the great high place. So again, we see this tension happening here when he sins. But we also see this passage, and hopefully it gives us a great and glorious truth of how God relates to his people. That even in this passage, we see that Solomon is not perfect. He does love God. There's no doubt about it. Chronicles clearly explains that it is his God. But God does not wait for Solomon then to be perfect. It's not trying to paint a picture of a pro-Solomon, anti-Solomon. I think it paints the picture of reality. Even if you just think about Solomon's family tree, why is he here? He is here because his father had his mother's husband murdered and took her to be his wife. And here we see that glorious truth again that God still speaks to his people. And here God appears to Solomon in a dream, just like he did to Abraham, just like he did to Jacob. Both of these men were not perfect either, and yet God appeared to them in chapter 15. As the sun was going down, the deep sleep fell on Abram, and behold, dreadful and great darkness fell upon him. In Jacob, Genesis 28. And he dreamed, and behold, there was a ladder set up on the earth, and the top of it reached to heaven. And behold, the angels of God were ascending and descending on it. And here God asked Solomon, what would he like? And Solomon does not respond with money, power, health. What does Solomon say? I'm going to read verse 5 and then begin with verse 6. At Gibeon, the Lord appeared to Solomon in a dream by night, and God said, "What? Ask what I shall give you." And Solomon said, "You have shown great and steadfast love to your servant David, my father, because he walked before you in faithfulness, in righteousness, and in uprightness of heart towards you. And you had kept for him this great and steadfast love and given him a son to sit on his throne this day. And now, O Lord my God, you have made your servant king in place of David my father. Although I am but a little child, I do not know how to go out or come in. And your servant is in the midst of your people, whom you have chosen, a great people, too many to be numbered or counted for multitude. Give your servant, therefore, an understanding mind to govern your people, that I may discern between good and evil. For who is able to govern this your great people?" Now we could begin to try and unpack this at great length, but maybe just to point out a couple of things. Notice how Solomon turns straight to God and gives him praise. He begins speaking of God's faithfulness, God's great and steadfast love. He understands that this is because of God's steadfast love, not because of who Solomon is. He does not deserve to be there, per se. This is why Solomon sits on the throne, because God is faithful. The second thing that he explains is that not only God is faithful, but because of David and his faithfulness is why he sits on the throne. No. Solomon points out that David was a man after God's own heart. But also, if we think about that, we think about how God is faithful to David. Not merely that David was a good man, but because God is faithful to David and God is carrying out his promises that he made to David. And this is something we should have in the back of our minds as we think about going through the book of 1 and 2 Kings, is that when we think about how God relates to his people, it always comes through promise. Particularly God's answered promises. Here you see Solomon, and he speaks of this great people. Too many to be numbered, a multitude. A great people he is. And again, if we think back to that situation where God appeared to Abram and God appeared to Jacob in dreams, we're in chapter 15 just before. And he brought him outside and said, "Look towards heaven and number the stars, if you are able to number them." And he said to them, so shall your offspring be," or in Genesis chapter 28, "your offspring shall be like the dust of the earth, and you shall spread abroad to the west and to the east and to the north and to the south. And in you, your offspring, shall all the families of the earth be blessed." So here, Solomon is able not just to be able to say that you are faithful, God, but I see how you have been faithful because there is a great numerous people that I have to govern. It is no small task. From the time when Israel moved to Egypt, they were but a family with about 70 people. But here, now, they're a great, numerous nation which needs to be governed. And Solomon understands that it's God's faithfulness towards his promises. But he says there's something lacking here. The thing that is lacking is not your promises. The thing that is lacking is me. Solomon understands that he is but like a small child. I cannot do this mammoth task. And we often think that we cannot accomplish a task because we don't have enough money. We don't have enough strength. But here, Solomon understands his greatest weakness is none of those things, but it's that he is not able. He is like a small child, been given a nail gun and told to build something great. And he understands, I don't know how. I don't know how to go out or come in. It speaks specifically of leadership. Numbers 27, Deuteronomy 31, Joshua 14. Look, I understand you're being faithful to your promise to be able to make me king. But there is so much I do not know. So his prayer, his request is quite simple, all found in verse 9. "Give your servant, therefore, an understanding mind to govern your people, that I may discern between good and evil, for who is able to govern this great people?" Again, King Solomon understands he is God's servant in this place. He understands that they are not his people to govern. They are God's people to govern. That he is merely a servant serving God, looking after his people. And he asks for wisdom. Solomon, when writing the Proverbs, said this in verse chapter 2, "My son, if you receive my words and treasure up my commandments with you, making your ear attentive to wisdom and inclining your heart to understanding. Yes, if you call out for insight and raise your voice for understanding, if you seek it like silver and search for it as hidden treasures, then you will understand the fear of the Lord and find the knowledge of God. For the Lord gives wisdom. From his mouth come knowledge and understanding. You want to speak of promises in the Bible? Here's a promise that we can take home, that we can be guaranteed God answers this prayer. The Bible never promises that we will have wealth or health or earthly happiness. But we're told that if any of us lacks wisdom, let him ask God, who gives generously to all without reproach, and it will be given him. Why is this? We often think that a fool is someone who doesn't have any wisdom. But the truth is not that a fool is someone who doesn't have any wisdom. The fool never seeks wisdom. The fool never is someone who hates wisdom. The fear of the Lord is beginning of knowledge. The fools despise wisdom and instruction. That a fool hates wisdom and therefore never seeks wisdom. And this wisdom is not some form of false wisdom, but it's true wisdom, which seeks to be able to place itself underneath God, listens to God, who is all-wise, all-powerful. The Lord, by wisdom, founded the earth. By understanding, he establishes the heavens. Edmund Clowney says, wisdom must be from God because it can be found only in relation to him. And here Solomon understands that he does not have this wisdom to be able to govern God's people. Trust in the Lord with all your heart and do not lean on your own understanding. And Solomon is saying, I can't lean on my understanding. I don't have any. I got to trust in the Lord with all my heart. In all your ways, acknowledge in him, and he will make straight your paths. Be not wise in your own eyes, and fear the Lord, and turn away from evil. Now, here we see something terrific that was something lacking for such a long time. What was the end of Judges? We come back to as we're thinking about kings and kings who sit on God's throne. What was the issue? In those days, there was no king in Israel, and everyone did what was right in his own eyes. But what is wisdom? Wisdom is not wisdom from our own eyes, but fearing the Lord, turning away from our evil ways. And here Solomon asks for wisdom. He understands this mammoth task before him of trying to be able to rule God's people, govern God's people. We also notice something in the book of Proverbs which teaches us that David had this same understanding as well. Proverbs chapter 4. Hear, O sons, a father's instruction, and be attentive that you may gain insight. For I give you good precepts, and do not forsake my teaching. When I was a son with my father, tender, the only one in the sight of my mother, he taught me and said to me, let your heart hold fast to my words. Keep my commandments and live. Get wisdom, get insight. Do not forget and do not turn away from the words from my mouth. Do not forsake her and she will keep you. Love her and she will guard you. The beginning of wisdom is this, get wisdom. And whatever you get insight. Prize her highly, and she will exalt you. She will honor you if you embrace her. She will place on your head a graceful garland, and she will bestow on you a beautiful crown. Why did Solomon ask for wisdom? Well, this has been instilled to him from his father David. What should you get? Get wisdom. Get insight. Do not forget. Do not turn away from the words of my mouth. Do not forsake her and she will keep you. Love her and she will guard you. The beginning of wisdom is what? To get wisdom. Now here Solomon asks, what is lacking in this kingdom? I don't understand. I don't know I need something, and that something is you to guide me and you to lead me. We find out this was a very pleasing prayer to God. In verse 10, and it pleased the Lord that Solomon had asked this. We'll see that just as this prayer pleased God, we will also see how Solomon makes the Lord angry. We'll see how this prayer is answered in the coming weeks as we look at Solomon's kingdom and his reign. Now we can see somewhat of how the New Testament authors maybe seek to be able to hint back to this from the New Testament, looking back, to be able to see how Solomon has his faults and his failures, things that are lacking. But we also see how Christ then comes to be able to fulfill where Solomon is lacking. Luke tells us that the child grew and became strong, filled with wisdom, and the favor of God was upon him. A couple of verses later, 52. And Jesus increased in wisdom and in stature, and in favor with God and man. Even this is something that people around him were not able to be able to understand. What did they say, who of those in his hometown? They were astonished. They said, where did this man get this wisdom and these mighty works? Well, we know where. It was from the Lord. He didn't come having the wisdom of the world. The wisdom given to him from God. Now we'll see Solomon, the wisest man who is sought after for his wisdom, he falls short. But we'll save that story for another day.
Thank you for listening to this sermon from Seven Springs Presbyterian Church. If you want to learn more about us, please find us on Facebook or visit us at sevenspringspresbyterian.com. Seven Springs Presbyterian Church began in 1874 and is a congregation of the Presbyterian Church in America located in Glade Spring, Virginia. Please join us for worship on Sunday at 10 a.m. and 6 p.m. for His glory and His gospel.